Hello. Hi. Awesome. Okay. My name's Louis. I'm part of an NGO called. Is this one? Is it? Right.
Hello.
Hello. No, it's these ones. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having my colleagues Sanjay and Katya, who also work in flood management and community flood response in the UK. Thanks to Alex for the impressive organization and to the translators. Do let me know if I'm going too fast. This is something that I generally do. I'm going to kind of preface my remarks by apologizing for, perhaps out of necessity, making very broad points based on experiences that are actually quite specific. And so when I'm going to speak about climate activism, I'm going to speak about climate activism as I've experienced it in Quebec, Canada, and the UK mainly. And when I'm going to speak about climate disasters or disasters writ large, I'm going to be referring a lot to experiences of flooding in the UK. And of course, Canada is not the UK, and the UK is not Germany. And so it will have to be in discussion that you can tell me to what extent these generalizations actually apply and are useful to you, or if we can completely toss them out the trash, and that's absolutely fine as well. There we go, much better. When I was in Canada, the climate movement was a kind of coalition of frontline communities that were fighting extractive industry, pipelines, mines, dams on rivers, forestry, what have you, often and not always indigenous. And then a certain amount of frontline communities that were just downstream of petrochemical industry or heavy industry as well, mercury, paper mills and the likes. And then a kind of uncomfortable alliance of these kinds of communities and then urban, educated, more white, overwhelmingly white in some cases, concerned people. That was the kind of makeup of the climate movement. And so part of the message that the people in the cities and that kind of the types of people who would rock up to, a Fridays for the Future march was to the other concerned people in the cities was pointing to the front lines and saying, "You're next," right? And trying to make other people concerned about that. And a lot of the structure of the politics of the alliance was a kind of deference principle to center the front lines, right? Those people out there who, at least in traditional voting metrics, have less power, but are actually extremely effective at stopping pipelines and forestry-type projects, right? And when we were saying "you're next" to our fellow kind of urban dwellers, if you will, suburban as well, part of the pattern that's been happening over the last year and the last years is that that's kind of what's been happening, right? And so if we look at the UK, this is the lovely town of Shrewsbury, and it routinely looks like that at this point. And so what I kind of want to start by saying is that this challenges the understanding of the front lines that the movement that I was a part of had, right? The disasters, the direct impacts were often conceived of as kind of people far away from us who don't look like us or something, and now, lo and behold, Los Angeles is on fire. Right? Valencia's very, very, very badly flooded. Shrewsbury, as you can see in this case, is routinely very, very badly flooded. So it's not good. And at the time, again in Canada, almost unsaid, there was this kind of theory about what would happen when that happened, that we'd finally be proven right. "We told you so," right? And there was this kind of hope that we would then be vindicated. And what climate activists want from disasters or want from disaster survivors was the hope that all of a sudden, all of the disaster survivors would then be the next generation of Greta Thunbergs, right? We would dramatically grow the base. We would grow the base in those places where we're notoriously really bad at growing the base. It would finally no longer be this kind of all of the power and the NGO money sitting in highly educated places or something, right? And if you look at, you know, in this case, you've got Sunrise Movement activists on my right, your left, and on the right, you've got the kind of generic British archetype of the everyman, right? In the UK, a really good colleague lent me a book that says that the flip side to the imaginary of the hipster is the imaginary white working class. Anyone with a Yorkshire accent is automatically considered the beating heart of England. This weird presupposition that anyone outside of London is automatically more authentic than the people in the cities, and that's who we really need to talk to. And so the hope on some way was that this gentleman in his army uniform would become one of us, right? Climate activism, as I've experienced it, seemed to want of climate disasters that they would grow the base and finally push us over the edge and beat the fossil fuel industry. And I want to kind of say that I actually really support this project of building an alliance with disaster survivors, but I'm going to be extremely critical of some of the assumptions behind the way that this project is actually being carried out or not carried out at all. Some are naive, some are a bit lazy, and maybe even a bit arrogant. Because, of course, the theory has not been happening at all, right? On your left, post-Valencia Spanish socialist minister being like, hey, these guys are really going on the far right. On your right, a kind of celebrity German activist just pointing out that extreme weather failing to encourage political climate action, says activist. And on the top right, polling attitudes and quantitative research. So the first thing that I'd say about climate activism and climate disasters is that there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that being exposed to a climate disaster makes you more into climate policies, right? The kind of people who flood are not automatically very interested in hanging out with us, right? And also, this belies the fact that, at least in Canada, we're not even reaching out to these people, right? There is no organization that goes into a kind of disaster response, disaster recovery after a wildfire when Jasper, you know, Jasper burnt to the ground. It's this kind of like quaint town, well, very pretty town. We're not there in the first place. So there was almost this kind of belief that we didn't even need to do anything. They'd just see we were right, right? That's a bit of a caricature, but if we look at the actual behavior of a lot of the organizational capacity, at least in Canada, and if we look at the UK as well, this is borne out, that we're not terribly active about reaching these people, and they are not terribly interested in us. So, short of actually going and, you know, meeting them, what's been going on? In the discourse, this is a bloke called James O'Brien. He's a liberal commentator. I actually really like him. And you can read that after Valencia, he, do we owe Just Stop Oil an apology? Well, I can definitely tell you that the people in Valencia who lost a lot of people do not owe anyone an apology. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that one of the strands of kinds of things in the discourse coming out of well-established liberal and climate organizations when these things happen is, I told you so. And just on an intuitive level, that doesn't strike me as a terribly helpful thing to say to someone who's just lost their house or their friend, right? And we'll talk about these people a bit more after. So that's one strand of response in the discourse when these things happen in the places that we, that at least I haven't been habituated to see them happen. We're right. We owe Just Stop Oil an apology. Okay. It actually, to my mind, gets even worse than that. So there seems to be a kind of, in the UK and to a certain extent in Europe, continental, a strand of the kind of 2019 climate movement that has grown into what you could call a form of middle-class prepperism and really, really likes Occupy Sandy, right? There's like entire books about how awesome Occupy Sandy was and how Occupy Sandy's the future, right? And in this case, the discourse is actually saying that these floods, these disasters are inevitable, they're just gonna keep happening and you need to just kind of embrace that and build around it. And what's really interesting and disturbing about that is that that is the message of the British government as well, right? In the UK, climate change is, there's this other message. So there's, we were right. And then there's climate change as excuse, as a message, right? And the British government goes around telling people that, well, with climate change, we can't really do anything about it. You just need to get better at coping with 3 feet of sewer entering your home on a regular occurrence. Most people would rather kill themselves if they can't move, right? There are genuine suicide cases that we encounter, and we hear these stories a lot more than we should. So when I was a young campaigner, like 2 years ago, I kind of had this old Greenpeace geezer just give me this really interesting tip, and it was like, you never campaign on a tragedy. You have to make it unacceptable, right? To most of the public, the poor are always going to starve. That's just how the world is. You need to show them who stopped them getting food. And you extend that to, all right, the floods are always going to happen, but who screwed up? And guess what? Some people out there are really good at communicating like that. So when the constituency of Doncaster, I believe, flooded this year, MP Richard Tice of Reform, not a nice guy by most accounts. Here's the headline: flood bosses care more about voles, which is a nice little water animal, than people, says MP. And his quote reads as follows: the Environment Agency is failing to dredge the rivers properly, and the priorities of badgers and water voles on riverbanks are treated more seriously than the welfare of residents, households, and businesses, and that's completely unacceptable. Ergo, the reason you flooded is because environmentalists were protecting the rivers, the guys on the, you know, the animals on the riverside. The worst part of that is that it's not entirely untrue. Of course, that's not why you're flooding. But from the standpoint of the people out there, the people delivering environmental conservation laws are also the people delivering bad news. And that message has an awful lot of traction because they're also latching on to a very plausible boogeyman that, you know, in just basic comms terms is working. And so it's a bit of a challenging situation, as you can see. The good news will come after. But it's really interesting because these things are actually now borne out by polling evidence, which is that, like, in the lives of the people on the receiving end of disasters, climate change is a factor and a really hard one to pin down. Because if you look at flooding, in plumbing, you can create a disaster by putting more stuff in, but you can also really neglect the capacity to take stuff out. And my God, have we been doing that in the first place? So everything is very multi-causal. Everything is very complicated and very negative, and pinning down climate change as a signal within this is actually quite tricky. Not all flooding is caused by climate change. Disasters are always at the confluence of human factors and infrastructure and aggravating factors on the receiving end, and that's why perhaps in LA, the Trump narrative about, you know, some bullshit happening upstream seemed plausible because it latches on to things that are quite tangible. And so here's a quote in the in this very big report that was commissioned, not by us, we don't have the money for that. They mostly blame poorly maintained and outdated drainage and sewage systems for this, as well as new housing developments that reduce land for natural absorption and do not have adequate drainage, and wetter weather from climate change. That is also our experience of talking to flooded people. They're not dumb. They know that there's a lot of different factors involved. And the logical thing to do, if I'm going to come in and your house is flooded, and I'm like, right, in order to stop this from happening, you need to change the entire world energy system. That's not really a good message to hear, because you might as well shoot yourself at this point, frankly, if it's sewer flooding in particular. So at that point, when these kinds of aspirations that we have just really not been panning out, I think it's time to take a step back, and maybe we can ask ourselves, well, what do we even know about disasters and disaster survivors? And my answer is that unless you're actually one of them, or you've taken a degree in disaster studies, which is a thing, or you've worked in humanitarian aid, you probably know extremely little about disaster survivors, right? And the assumptions that we had, that these people were just gonna flock to us in a kind of righteous moment of, my God, you were right, need to be completely revisited and abandoned, right? it doesn't really matter if we're right. This problem of being kind of like coming in and just after all these radio interviews with like annoying right-wing people being like, it's not that bad. And we're like, see, we're right, it is that bad, is not really the good attitude to bring to these communities, right? And I take a really big exception to the idea that a post-Extinction Rebellion climate activist has anything to teach a repeat flooded pensioner in England about collapse. I really do. And I know Extinction Rebellion inside out, maybe not the German chapters as much. So maybe we can go back to the basics, because the tradition that we're in actually has a lot of information about community work. We do know this, it's in our DNA, right? You don't turn up to a community like a preacher. Quote Paulo Freire, the more radical the person is, the more fully he or she enters into reality, so that, knowing it better, he or she can transform it. This individual is not afraid to confront, to listen, to see the world unveiled. This person is not afraid to meet the people or to enter into dialogue with them. Emphasis mine, this person does not consider himself or herself the proprietor of history or of all of the people or the liberator of the oppressed, but he or she does commit himself or herself within history to fight at their side. We cannot come into disaster zones as somehow revealing the big climate truth we've been holding to them. It's a terrible idea and it's not going to work. Don't try it. So instead, we could actually take an interest in disasters, because there's a whole academic field dedicated to disasters with debates in it and stuff, right? Like, a lot of people out there have been thinking about disasters for a long time. And we can maybe start with our cherished Occupy Sandy and our kind of aspirations of noble mutual aid to ride out the storm. This academic here writes, quote, the case of Occupy Sandy serves as a counter history to the way in which community-run disaster aid presents itself today. Rather than in opposition to the state, self-organized social reproduction integrates itself functionally into a new interplay between the state, the market, and civil society. A movement that merely performs relief labor for free does not break with community's state-imposed vulnerability. So, in plain English, what this guy is arguing is that we tend to think of disasters as time-slice events, but the disaster happened ages before in the differential exposure of people to hazards and in their abandonment in the recovery period, and that increasingly in disaster studies we see a passing of that reproductive labor of disaster response and disaster recovery from the state to the market, and when the market isn't interested, directly to civil society. And so Occupy Sandy ended up playing into these dynamics rather than undermining them. So we don't want to do that. And we can also start to look at flooded people's reality in a good kind of Ferrarian tradition. What's tangible to them? Risk management authorities in England, flood action groups, insurers, loss assessors, builders, flood alleviation schemes, dredging, construction, water company, post-traumatic stress disorder, these are all very, very, very visible aspects of a disaster zone or a flood zone in England. Climate change and fossil fuel companies are not really something that you can grasp. So there's a lot of work to be doing to make these dots and to build this alliance, of course. And of course, again, kind of pushing back against the kind of climate collapse attitude, for this person here, there's an awful lot of things that can be done to help them and make their lives a hell of a lot better that don't involve changing the entire world energy system, right? A flood alleviation scheme, flood walls, proper emergency response, support and recovery, these are life or death things for the people in there. And once we get proper disaster management, then they might be interested in talking about net zero and stuff like that. And that is what they tell us, right? We can try and slip in polluter pays types ideas or something like that because these are relevant, but a lot of the floods are caused by the water company and by the developer, right? Climate, as always, is a contextual factor. And finally, in the UK, climate is sometimes used as an excuse to then keep doing the obviously stupid stuff that's causing this. Oh, it's climate change, but I'll just build 300 homes next to your floodplain neighborhood, even as it floods repeatedly. These are the kinds of things that are still in play for disaster victims. In this case, I think we can take some inspiration from housing rights advocates. There's an extremely interesting blog on the experience of the London Renters Union. And this guy asks, what is it that leads some members of London Renters Union to defer their vision of a better future to a post-revolutionary scenario that appears out of reach in our lifetimes, while others want a positive and practical narrative of what housing should look like? We need to ask the painful question of whether the material position of some young, middle-class London Renters Union members is what leads them to set aside what I have suggested is the quote-unquote common sense type of radicalism. The context for this is that the London Renters Union was launched and composed kind of by brilliant, relatively affluent socialists who decided to build like a labor union of some of the most oppressed renters in London. And a lot of these people just weren't that interested in capitalism. They wanted to own homes, right? And so the question was, is there a kind of reform versus revolution tension? And he says, no, we're just failing to see the situation from their standpoint, and we need to appreciate our different positions relative to this. The same can go in here. Flooded people are not any dumber to climate change than climate activists, I would imagine, but they are also directly in the firing line of giant amounts of dirty water destroying their lives, and the priorities need to be a synthesis of that. So, I've spoken about what climate activism demands of disasters, and I think the real question here is what would disaster survivors want from climate activists in the first place if we're to lead to and meet these people? Understanding and empathy is the first thing because it is cruelly lacking in the disaster zone. Visibility, dignity, humanity, warmth, support in the long recovery period once the blue lights have gone, political muscle to get redress and protection, and then maybe a synthesis will come with an environmental analysis. It's worth saying that, you know, we might sometimes see the world as us versus the other side, the target side or whatever, fossil capitalism. They are liable to see the world as everyone for themselves. That's definitely how things are in the UK flood space. So if we want to build this alliance, then climate activists need to work for flooded people in this case. And we need to trust them to draw their own conclusions about what's best for them. They know they're on the firing line of climate change. Some will be climate skeptics, by the way, but they have no one coming for them to help. And if we step into that place, a lot of bridges can be built, even with climate skeptics, and we have people who are not that interested in climate within our membership as well. They will not be terribly interested in the radical culture of the social movement, some of them. So the question is, what are we prepared to give up to be the truly radical organizer in the spirit of Freire, right? And in this case, this is Nunes. The pedagogical process was understood as the confluence of different knowledges held by the teacher and student alike and striving towards whatever emancipation participants managed to produce together rather than the realization of some pre-established goal set from the outside. I repeat, these people are as aware of what's going on as we are. They know in their own way just how bad and rotten the system is. They do not need radicalization. What needs to happen is genuine working together to produce a new politics that merges our concerns and theirs. So to the practical at Flooded People UK, we've got, luckily thanks to Sanjay and Katya and people like that, a huge amount of experience of being in these communities, and we have charted out the different episodes and learnings that people go from. So there's the kind of first shock community when they are just interested in making it stop. There's not even an interest in national policy. And people tend to then go into the bureaucracy, realize for themselves how broken everything is, and when they hit their limits locally, they then became interested in national. And when they will hit their limits national, then they might very well be interested in global climate justice or anything else that some climate activist concerns are. We can share these slides. So there is a learning journey. And I'll conclude that it's hard, but the theory is possible. I don't think that the climate movement can afford to lose disaster survivors as part of the political struggle here. And I also think that flooded people in particular, climate disaster survivors, need all the help they can get, frankly. So if we can be smart about this, there is a happy alliance to be built. My colleague Sanjay will give a workshop on exactly how to do that. Short answer is we don't know for sure, but we have tips. I hope that some of these things may or may not be applicable to the different kinds of countries and situations and organizations that you're in. Otherwise, again, thank you for your attention, having me on stage, and I hope I didn't speak too fast.